salvation. Wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a
religion. Hey friends, you're listening to Roker Genesis here on KSKQ 89.5 FM Ashland, 94.1 FM Medford. That's Tracy Chapman. Talk about a revolution. People gonna rise up and take what's theirs. All right. Roker Genesis has been coming to you live on Thursdays at 9 a.m. for over 2 years, and today we have a very special guest in studio, as announced, Eli Jackson Bear, founder of the Leela Foundation and author of An Outlaw Makes It Home, The Awakening of a Spiritual Revolutionary. Before we hear from Eli, I'd like to read some reviews of this wonderful book. Outlaw rocks. Brutally honest yet deeply loving. This takes great courage. Bravo, Ed and Deb Shapiro, authors of The Unexpected Power of Mindfulness and Meditation. An Outlaw Makes It Home bears it all in this rapid-fire compilation of adventures, a serious quest for spiritual wisdom and enlightenment with a startling turn in the heartwarming discovery after an 18-year search. Jackson Bear does not spare himself or try to polish his flaws and mistakes. In that regard, he is a warrior. I consumed this book in huge gulps and would do it again. I urge others to read it. That was none other than Peter Coyote, Emmy Award-winning actor and author of The Rain Man's Third Cure. And finally, from Nancy Baker, Zen Roshi, and professor of philosophy of Sarah Lawrence College, An Outlaw Makes It Home can be seen as a coming-of-age story, a modern journey of self-discovery, but it is also a classic hero's journey, an odyssey and a return home. And what a journey and what a home. Eli takes us from a shattering moment in his Brooklyn childhood through radical and sometimes terrifying times in the 60s, his escape to Peru, and later travels in Japan, Morocco, India, and his adventures back home in the U.S., all leading to his waking up and discovering what home truly is. His honesty about fear and failure are moving, but what really shines forth from these pages are a fierce love and commitment to the truth. I absolutely loved this story, says Nancy Baker. Let's check your mic right now, Eli. Can you say 1, 2, 3?
Okay, I'm here.
You are. You are live, and we thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, you, I should say, are related to another former guest on Roker Genesis, the one and only Ganga G. And she did suggest that you should be on the show because I have heard of the Leela Foundation. Do we want to go into that just for a couple minutes before we discuss the book about your work with the Leela Foundation?
Sure. So Tracy Chapman says everybody's going to rise up and get what's theirs. When I was younger, I was a revolutionary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a federal fugitive living in the backwoods in Colorado. I was practicing with my M1 because the unmarked vans started showing up in my gulch in the backwoods. And so
wow.
I felt it coming, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I realized that we're not going to win with guns.
Correct.
And so we had to have something else. And I didn't know what else it was. In those days, there was no meditation, there were no gurus, there was no yoga, nobody had heard of enlightenment.
Not in America.
Not in America. Not in my America. And it was before the Tibetans came, it was before the Zen people came. And so I didn't know what to do, but I knew we had to do something. And so I looked for magic. And for me, LSD was magic. And so I fasted for 3 days and took 500 mics of LSD, which was two hits of those 250 mic doses. Now they're like micro dosing. They're doing like one and two, but this was a major hit. And I experienced my own death. And in dying, I woke up. And in waking up, I realized if everyone could realize what I've realized, the world would come to peace.
So do you mean the death of your ego, or what did it feel like?
It felt like I was dying. Well, first of all, acid can make you really paranoid. And so I've been fasting for 3 days. I've got these strange people showing up in my gulch. I mean, I had a plumber come to my cabin, and I had an outhouse. And so it was, you know, all the shady stuff going on. I became paranoid. And I thought, well, I'm going to die here tonight. They know I'm tripping. My cabin is wired. They know I'm tripping. They're going to come and get me.
Ah.
And if it, well, if I'm going to die, I want to make good use of my death. And so to make good use of my death, I used it to call for help. So I thought, if there's anything alive in this universe, something must know what's going on down here and doesn't know, and needs to know. And so I called for help. And in that, I woke up outside of the world. I woke up in what I called outer space. I had no other word for it. And I was alive and free, immortal consciousness.
Is that like a rebirthing?
No.
No.
No. It's like a death.
A true transcendental state.
Transcendental state.
Okay.
From fasting and being so concentrated. I mean, you know, I was really, I'm alone, I'm hunted, I'm scared, and I'm reading whatever I could. I was reading the metaphysics of the time. I was reading Gurdjieff and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I was reading all my spiritual stuff that I could get from a, from the only bookstore in town.
Gurdjieff's amazing.
Yes, he is. And so he's, his work actually, it turns out, comes from Pythagoras. I just discovered that this past 2 years.
The fundamentals of the operation of the universe.
That's right, which comes from Pythagoras. Pythagoras is the first person who calls the universe a cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Which and means one.
Actually, it's Greek, and it has two. It means interconnected and harmonious.
Mm.
And so Pythagoras' mathematics, which is what leads to the Enneagram, one of the things that I teach, is about the harmonics of the universe. And that's Gurdjieff also. That's his thing. So he is really teaching something he learned from a mystery school that was teaching Pythagoras.
So after you woke up, how did you use your consciousness differently? What was your seeking only just beginning, or?
That was the beginning of my search.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it took me 18 years to find my final teacher. At first, I thought if I just gave everyone acid, they would wake up. That didn't work. Because you had to have the circumstances. If you were a federal fugitive and you were facing death and you had these, you know, I was jumping out my cabin door with my gun, practicing shooting at the road. If you were in those circumstances and you took acid, it was very different from, you know, you take it as a party thing.
Yeah, I don't think acid and guns mix very well.
Yeah.
Go on then.
No, they don't. So I didn't know, I didn't have anything. When I woke up, I knew giving people acid didn't work. I had to find someone more awake than I was.
Uh-huh.
And so I went on a search. I went on a spiritual search. And I spent 18 years, and I went through all the different traditions, all the gurus, all the, I was Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism. I was with Muktananda when he first came to America. So I saw the whole scene, and none of it was real to me until I met my teacher in 1990, and that changed everything.
I knew some people who were with Muktananda, and apparently that he was a real teacher.
He was. Before I met him, I didn't believe anything was as powerful as LSD. Muktananda's Shakti was as strong as LSD. And, I mean, literally, you could trip on
it. Let's explain to people what Shakti is if they don't understand, because it's like chi, right?
Or chi. Mm-hmm. Chi is Shakti. It's spiritual energy. It's emanations.
Mm-hmm.
Someone once told me, because, anyway, it's a long story, but someone once said to me, if you just touch his foot, and I touched his foot as he walked by, and it was like electricity went up my arm, and I started tripping from the whole experience.
Right.
When I first met him, I was homeless. I was living on the beach in Santa Monica. I had no money. I had no job. I had no possessions. I had no possibilities. I was just hanging out, writing a screenplay. And I was,
as a lot of people do in LA.
Yeah. And I was in these waterfront, oceanfront Santa Monica cottages that had been saved by the Coastal Commission. So they were still cheap. There was an alternative film community living in them, and I would house it with these people. I'd borrow a bike and go pick the fruit trees in Westwood and trade them at the health food store. And I was playing Frisbee on the beach one day with a guy named Yogi, who was named after Yogi Berra, the Yankee, kind of a homely New York hero.
My best friend in New Jersey lived across the street from Yogi Berra, but that's just a little synchronicity.
There you go. So Yogi and I are playing Frisbee, and Muktananda's first trip to America, they have to round people up for his satsang, and they heard there was a yogi on the beach. And so they came to get the yogi, which they thought meant something else. And so they brought Yogi in. They brought me to meet this guy. We'd never heard of him. We didn't know who he was. And when I first saw him, I thought maybe he was a CIA plant to disrupt the spiritual scene. He's wearing sunglasses and his watch cap, and he's got these, you know, bodyguards behind him. And I wasn't much interested. I was fasting at the time, and they gave out prasad, which is holy from the guru, and it was chocolate fudgesicles, which is like, I ate three of them.
Huh.
I thought, this is proof the guy's a CIA agent. This is how I'm breaking my fast, you know, with chocolate fudgesicles. But his power, even though I had no relationship with the guy, within 2 weeks, I had an oceanfront apartment overlooking Venice Beach. I had a silver 1957 Chevrolet, a silver racing bicycle, and a job working as a staff research associate at UCLA in the psychology department. And that was just from, I mean, that came out of nowhere.
Well, it's interesting because I used to sit with gurus quite a lot. One of them had a great name, Sri 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 Shiva Bala Yogi Maharaj. But the friend of mine who sat with him most and who had meditated for 25 years prior to that every day told me that he felt the effect of this guru was karma neutralizing. So maybe these gurus do have a way of opening doors for us so that we can see what the possibilities are. But then we're then responsible for keeping that door open.
He can take you so far, but he didn't take you to freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was about power and magic and incredible things.
Right.
And actually, I met my life partner at one of his morning meditations.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. In Berkeley, when he first opened his place in Berkeley, in Oakland, I just happened from my job at UCLA that he got me. They sent me to Berkeley to do this thing, and I went to Berkeley, and it turns out he had just shown up in Berkeley and went to his morning thing, and then I met my partner, Tony, who then became Gangaji.
That's a trip and a half right there. So in your journey, An Outlaw Makes It Home, chronicled in this book, An Outlaw Makes It Home, your awakening was a destination of sorts? I mean, it says that you arrived home, but what is home? I'm needing to understand what is home.
Home is what doesn't come or go.
That's what Gangaji talks about.
Oh, it's my wife.
What doesn't come or go is the enduring self, the Atman, the supreme self. Who is this person?
So all those are concepts
trying to grasp
what can't be grasped.
There you go.
And so they all point, it's like the finger pointing at the moon is not the moon. So every word you said is pointing to something that can't be held or described, yet is always here.
Totally.
It's what's conscious. It's what sees with the eyes but can't be seen. It's what hears with the ears but can't be heard.
But you can't get there without kind of being spiritually Rolfed or something, so that all the knots in your being are starting to come undone. And
not necessarily.
No?
No. You look at the Zen master Hui Nung, who was a woodcutter in China in the 600s. He was delivering a load of wood. He had no spiritual anything, but he overheard the monks reciting the Diamond Sutra. And just hearing that, he woke up. So, and they weren't awake. They were just monks doing their chants. But he woke up just in his readiness. So he didn't have to do anything.
That's wonderful. But,
and he founded the Southern School Sudden Awakening lineage that is now called Zen. Although he was in China, where it's called Chan. Zen is the Japanese mispronunciation of Chan.
If only it were that easy for most of us. I think that the journey part demoralizes us sometimes. I know I've had trials and tribulations of late that have made me feel like I know God or spirit or whatever you want to call it is on my side, totally supporting me, and yet I'm being put through my paces.
That is supporting you. It's not yet.
It's by being put through my paces. Okay, so it's like a crucible.
That's right. It's a crucible. And the sooner you stop fighting with it, the faster it goes.
Thank you. And why do you think you struggled before reaching home? Why do you think that you had been in a pitched battle with yourself or with the world or fearful? Or what was that conditioning that you received from outside of yourself?
You know, growing up, I was never happy. I grew up in a normal, what would appear to be happy family. And everyone around me seemed to be happy and normal. And I could see they were all lying. And so when I was 10 years old, I made a vow. I wasn't going to bring children into this world. I didn't want to pass on the suffering that was passed on to me. Mm. And actually, that was my mother's curse to me. She said, you wait till you have children and see how they treat you. And I thought, whoa, I'm not going to. I don't want to do that. I don't want to pass on the suffering that I've gotten, even though it seems so happy and everybody seems so. I mean, it was the middle class white America, but it wasn't real.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gave me that meant I didn't have to have a career. I didn't have to settle down. I didn't have to have a family. And that freed me up. And so then I could give my life, if my life was worthless and unhappy, which it was, I could give it to something more important.
But still, I mean, yet still, you had to come out of a darkness of sorts, or
sure,
a dark night of the soul. I've read some of your trials and tribulations. I mean, you've been in and out of the prison system.
Yeah.
In your youth.
Seven times.
You are someone who had to actually even...
I was a federal fugitive.
Go on the lam, yeah.
Federal fugitive for two counts of assault on a police officer for trying to freed a prisoner and jumped a cop, trying to stop the government. In May days of 1971, we went to Washington saying, if the government won't stop the war, we'll stop the government. And we tried to stop the government by shutting down the city, by shutting down the traffic circles and all the bridges. And the government brought in the 101st Airborne to occupy the city. It was an actual military occupation of Washington, D.C. And during that time, my group, we were trying to stop it. They busted one of my people. I jumped the cop and freed the guy. And then they chased me, knocked me down. I wasn't very fast. And ended up in prison. And then when I got out, I went underground after my federal grand jury indictment.
What did you learn while you were in prison?
Nothing. I wasn't in that long. I was bailed out. I was there under the name of Norman Brown, because I had Norman Brown's draft card, and so I got bailed out as Norman Brown. My federal indictment was for Norman Brown.
Wow, what an illustrious life! But what has it taught you about compassion and that kind of thing to have gone through these struggles?
When I saw this policeman in Washington taking away this guy, I was maybe 50 feet away from him. And in that moment, I knew without a doubt that this cop was my brother, that he and I were just playing a role on this stage, mm-hmm. and that I had complete compassion for both the policeman and for the officer, mm-hmm. and I had to do what I had to do. And I ran up, grabbed him from behind, knocked him down, and yelled, "Split," and the guy split. And then the policeman's partner knocked me down. But I knew at that point that he was my brother.
Right.
And so really my mission started when I was 18 and I went to Alabama with SNCC.
Well, this is nonviolent civil disobedience.
What is?
What you're doing with all, when you protest like this, and even if you have to, you know, help other people with force, that's not violence as such. If you're,
I broke the rules. You
did
know.
You hit him though?
No.
No, you just pulled him off the
I
guy.
Grabbed him and, you know, freed the prisoner, yeah.
I think that's pretty bold, man.
Well, it started when I was in Alabama with SNCC, when we were facing posse men with whips and clubs on horses. And I was 18 years old. And that's what blew my mind. That's what changed my life.
Like in the remnants of the Jim Crow South, huh? What years?
65. So this is when Montgomery in Alabama. Mm-hmm. So similar to Montgomery March happened after the violence.
Mm-hmm.
So the violence was happening in Selma, where the police were using police dogs and fire hoses. And Reverend Reeb, who they're just now on the news the other day, I heard they finally found the murderer of Reverend Reeb. Reverend Reeb was a white northern minister, came to Selma to help, got off the bus, and was beaten to death. And they never did anything about it till just now. It's now been revived.
Wow.
So that's going on. And that's on the news every day. You see the guys being attacked with dogs and fire hoses, and I took a bus to Montgomery, where the SNCC was the radical left wing of Martin Luther King was in the center in Selma. The radical left was with Stokely Carmichael in Montgomery, and that's where I was. And so we were marching to the state capitol also, and posse men were beating us back. And then the Selma to Montgomery march was announced, and everything changed. Johnson announced the Civil Rights Act. It changed the world.
Well, let's not digress too much on this next question, but do you think that, as we were talking about Tracy Chapman and, you know, rising up, that there is an opportunity in this world still for things like the social unrest of the 60s in its constructive aspects? could be repeated today.
It already has started. You know, it's a new generation, and
well, like with the women's marches, for sure,
for sure. So that's a start. You know, it started with civil rights marches, but it got bigger. You know, I mean, Martin Luther King eventually did, you know, a poverty march. I mean, he was doing it for all poor people, not just for Black people. And so,
right,
you start where you start, and then it grows. And so, yeah, of course, there has to be civil nonviolent disobedience against what's happened to our country. We've lost our republic.
Yeah, quite a while ago, I think. But we're listening to Eli Jackson Bear, author of An Outlaw Makes It Home, here on Rogue Regenesis. And the Leela Foundation that you founded, is it informed? I mean, this is a silly question, but is it informed by your spiritual journey?
So part of that is we have called the Leela School of Awakening.
Okay.
And it's for teaching teachers, guides, mentors, giving them both the possibility for insight and then the skillful means for how to use that to be a true friend to the world.
So Dharma practice, or what would you call it?
Call it being a true friend.
Being a true friend.
Because any practice assumes that you're not already there and that there's some place to get.
That's perfect. Thank you.
So it's about living it rather than practicing it.
Recognizing what is and what can never go away. I don't know what else to say, because every time I try to label it, you're just like, well, it's not really that. Well,
you can say that, but the trip is to be willing to live it, not just to think it, not believe it, not know it, but to actually walk the talk.
Well, living in the not know is very hard for Western people, I think, because we want certainty. We want to grasp some kind of dogma or truth that we use as a security blanket.
That's called ego.
Hmm. But it's so common.
Of course. Ego is the operating system. We were all born into it and trained into it. It's genetically what's happening, and it's also environmentally what's happening. It's how you survive, is to have an ego up until now. Now, this is the next stage in the evolution of the species, is called ego transcendence.
I'm really glad you said it that way, because for a long time I've wondered if humanity could have a dream, you know, that we can pass on to our youth. And in the old days, it used to be space travel, or maybe it's still space travel today. But what if transcending the ego became a social imperative that everybody was getting into? Like,
it is, and they are.
I must sound so silly to not know that, though. See, I run into a lot of resistance to my own free expression. When I try to be totally free, or not try, but when I feel like I'm being completely free, I end up causing abrasions against people that don't like me being that free.
So what?
Well, then my ego gets hurt because I upset them while trying to transcend my ego. It's a
beautiful. That means the ego that got hurt is the same one that's as bullshitting as if it's spiritual.
I see.
You wouldn't be heard otherwise.
Right. I'm attached to being heard. I'm attached to being seen and felt. And
exactly. And so then it becomes, rather than the expression of yourself, it becomes what you spiritually know. And it becomes your mental knowing that you're now spitting out on someone else to show that to help them.
Yes, I see this little catch 22 here. But what is the prescription then for ordinary people who don't have a practice as such to not achieve, but settle themselves into that knowing, but not knowing with a with a small K, but with a big K, you know?
Right. First, you have to want something more than what you've got. So if your life is already satisfactory and you sell out for it, you're never going to want anything more important. Mm-hmm. But if you just want something to add to what you've already got, which is so wonderful, that's just more spiritual ego. If you really see the whole nightmare and you're so disheartened and you're such despair at the condition of yourself and the world, then you're willing to look where you haven't looked before, which means you're willing to turn away from the known. Mm-hmm. And when you turn away from the known, you can then surrender to the unknown.
So spiritual ego is what happens when our so-called elevated concepts of ourselves turn into a form of materialism around how much we've attained.
And that's right.
And I think that is a real problem amongst so-called spiritual people, I've found. And I'm trying to be free of the trappings of spiritual materialism, but it is hard because you look at yourself in the mirror and you go, boy, I was really good in the way I, you know, helped that person. I raised them up. I got them out of their bad mood. And that makes me a good guy.
Right.
Right. And so I'm secretly patting myself on the back for being such a a minister of consciousness. Right?
Exactly. That's how the ego justifies itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes. And so the tendency is to take whatever we've realized and conceptualize it and make it part of me. So that, you know, I've got a higher self. I've got God on my side. Mm-hmm. I'm part of whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But it all becomes conceptualized through me and mine.
Mm.
If you're willing to just stop me and mine, everything takes care of itself quite naturally.
You said that so beautifully. And I feel almost like meditating or chanting at this moment because words do fail us in these arenas. But what are teachers who come to the Leela School and the Leela Foundation, what are they going to walk away with? Is there any, there's no guarantees, probably.
No. And if you're lucky, you walk away with nothing.
And people pay for that?
They'd rather pay for something.
But you see, what I believe is, and this could be more spiritual materialism warning, that when you are able to transcend the ego, or at least put some holes in it so you can see out of the cocoon, that somehow it does give you more facility in healing, maybe, or in showing up for people. And
well, if you're awake in the dream, you actually have a possibility to truly serve.
Awake in the dream.
Yeah, this is a dream world.
Yes.
And this dream world, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, I know it's a dream world. But just take the example of money.
Uh-huh.
What is money? It's pieces of paper.
Mm-hmm.
Pieces of paper or dots on a computer screen.
Phantom wealth is what it is.
And so wealth, money, paper, wealth, what makes that money valuable? It's a trance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a trance induction that I know that you believe this is real, so I can give it to you for something.
Wow.
But if everybody suddenly woke up from the trance of money, the world would collapse. We'd all die. That trance keeps the world going because we need money at this point.
Well, only because we've given so much of our power to it.
Exactly, because people can't survive now. You can't grow your own food and make your own clothes and put the electric on and do the gas. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like there's so much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's all dependent on money. And
right.
Money is a trance induction.
And they say there are no states in the United States where a minimum wage job is enough to pay rent.
Oh, that's right. We live in a that's right. No, we live in a a dichotomized, sick world, and it's based on money. Based on money and the marketplace. See, that's the god now.
Mm-hmm. Mammon.
That's why it's illegal to burn money.
It doesn't belong to the government, actually. The government licenses the use of the Federal Reserve's notes, and we, the people, pay for that privilege, which seems like a racket to me. But
it's all a trance induction. Everything that appears real is not real. Everything. If you look at it with science, just scientifically, you know that whatever you look at, if you look at it closely enough, it disappears. And the whole universe is blinking on and off.
Pavasambhava, I believe, said, as the universe is viewed, so it appears to us. Meaning, your eyes are not just perceiving, they're also casting a certain light out onto the world.
It's called casting a spell.
And you're seeing back what you put out of your eyes.
That's right.
And people don't understand that the eyes work in both directions. You're seeing is an act of
projection
onto the world.
Well, actually, onto a screen, not onto the world. The world is as it is. It's onto a screen that you then look back from the screen, see yourself in the screen and think that is the world.
Mm-hmm.
But we see a map. We don't see the world.
The map is not the territory.
Okay. So where'd that come from?
I had a mentor for many years who...
It comes from NLP.
Oh, does it?
And NLP got it from... Ecology of Mind. I forget his name, but that's where it comes from. So
it's nice.
Yeah, it's what it is that the world is mapped in our heads, and we live in the map.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see the thing out there as a being. We see a tree.
Well, you know, that's like the literalization of myth, right? People read things like the Bible as if every word is literal and much of it is metaphor, allegory, whatever.
It's a novel. And there are three great novels.
Heavily symbolic.
Three great novels came out of the Bronze Age. Okay, the Iliad and the Odyssey for the Greeks.
Homer.
Five books of Moses and the Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. Those three novels, and they are novels, all involve God and man, chariots, and because it's a Bronze Age thing, it's chariots and swords, mm-hmm. and morality. Mm-hmm. So the Iliad and the Odyssey are the Greek morality, how to be a Greek. It's about how to take care of your guest. The whole Odyssey is about being a guest,
yes,
and how to
is.
Take care of a guest. The five books of Moses is how to be you know, part of the group,
tribe,
part of the group that is the in group that you can kill everybody else. That's what God says.
Keep going. You're on a roll.
And the Mahabharata, Krishna comes down to be the charioteer for Arjuna to tell him, okay, you're fine to rebel against your relatives. Kill them. Doesn't matter. Go kill them. Whoever's going to die will die. That's karma. It's not your business. So all three of them are mythological novels based in the Bronze Age to give a coherent sense of ethos to the people that are reading it. And they all come about because this is the point where writing appears as an alphabet. Mm-hmm. And once you have writing as an alphabet, you can now take the oral histories, which is what Homer does, and write them down. You can take the oral history, which is what the Mahabharata does, write it down. And so once you write it down, it becomes more tangible. It seems like it's more real.
Bronze Age was when?
Bronze Age, so
like the Sumerian times? Or
past Sumerian. Sumerians okay. start out Stone Age, and then you get the Bronze Age. Uh-huh. And then copper is in between, and then bronze.
Okay.
So bronze is happening like 500 BC. So 500, 700 BC, you've got this thing. So it's like when Athens is fighting against Persia, they use bronze as their top off their vessels so that they can ram them. They make ramrods out of the bronze. Mm. So that's Bronze Age stuff. So that's when this is happening.
Far out. Yes, I read some of the Bhagavad Gita, which is got that charioteer part. And I find it curious, though, that if it's really just allegory, i.e. a novel, then what is it trying to tell us about ourselves?
Morality. It's okay to go kill your family.
Yeah, but why? But that isn't okay.
It is. So in the Bhagavad Gita, you do your duty, you swing your sword, and who dies, dies.
But of course, you're not advocating this kind of lifestyle.
I don't believe in any of these novels.
Right. Okay, that's why I call them novels. Well, listen, then if you read the story on the screen of the world today, there's a lot of similar moral conundra, you know.
Well, part of the problem is, if you look at the world today, how many Christians are there? How many billions of Christians? How many billions of Muslims? Mm-hmm. And they're all following a false god made up by the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
What a mess.
Yeah, like the way you said that. Yeah, what a mess. Yeah, my gosh. Yeah. But where we go with this is into an arena where, like John Lennon said, imagine no religion. I wonder if you can, you know. Isn't hard to do, maybe. But
the 18th century Enlightenment, everyone thought that would be the end of religion. Mm-hmm. And they see, oh my God, it's not the way the Bible says it. There's actually science.
Well, and also religion in those times became the power structure that was oppressing the people. So to some extent, it still does today through ideological means. Then, of course, there's the Catholic Church, which is, you know, still up to its old tricks. But I've even read articles that say that largely the U.S. foreign policy in this country is informed by right-wing Christian ideologues.
That's right.
And that's why we don't chastise Israel. That's why we allow the Palestinians to be massacred, because they don't belong in Israel, right?
Which is interesting.
What?
Is that Palestine actually comes from the Palace people. The Palace people are what's called in the Bible Philistines.
Mm-hmm.
So they were there first.
Sure they were.
And there, the Philistine capital was Sinai. And so they had cities that are actually still there.
That's so funny because Philistine is now considered an epithet.
Because of the five books of Moses.
Mm.
Because what happens is you have David versus Goliath. Goliath is the Philistine. David is the Stone Age kid using rocks to fight against the modern sword-bearing Bronze Age warrior. And so the reason...
Was he a Philistine?
Yeah.
Oh, look at that.
That's where it comes from. And that's because the Philistines were actually part of the Mediterranean culture. So they had Greek temples. They had urban living. They were sophisticated. And the Hebrews were the Stone Age shepherds who were fighting against what they call Philistines. So because they were not religiously correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so Samson and Delilah is another Philistine story. Delilah cuts off Samson's hair, makes him weak. What's that about? That's because the long-haired warriors were the Stone Age people, and the sophisticated Philistines cut their hair short in the Greek style because they were part of a more sophisticated Mediterranean culture.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's funny because I always thought Samson was the hero of that story. Now I'm seeing it the other way around. What the heck? You're changing my reality, Eli.
I hope so.
Well, that's the kind of stuff I wanted to delve into when I was talking about the literalization of myth, because you just did exactly what I believe we all need to do, which is unpack the historical data. I mean, as I understand it, since Aramaic was the original language of the New Testament, there's been like five different translations before it ever gets to our ears and eyes, and they've bastardized it.
They didn't have to.
Okay.
Just take the Ten Commandments, right?
Right.
So God writes these Ten Commandments in stone tablets that mm-hmm. Moses carries down.
Mm-hmm.
What language did God write it in? Since at that point, there was no Hebrew alphabet.
Uh-oh.
If he wrote it, if they were coming out of Egypt, which it turns out historically, they were never in Egypt. But assuming that they were in Egypt, they would have written it with papyrus and with Egyptian uh-huh. writing.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't. Why is it? It was written and carved into stone. Because the only written language at that time was from Samaria. And Sumerians wrote by carving...
Cuneiform
tablets, which is what Moses was carrying. Cuneiform tablets carved into the tablets. So right there, everybody for thousands of years has been reading that, and no one ever asked, what language?
Mm-hmm.
It's right there in front of us.
Very curious.
And Hebrew alphabet doesn't come along until Aramaic alphabet. The Aramaeans were trading people who actually came in through Babylonia, spread out, and since they were the traders, they needed to be communicating. And with cuneiform, it takes years and years and years to learn how to do it and to read it and write it. They needed something that everybody could do. And so the Aramaeans developed the first alphabet.
Mm.
It's called alphabet. Alpha is the first letter of Hebrew, of Greek, and bet is the first, second letter of Hebrew. So alphabet. Is from the alpha and the bet of Hebrew and Greek.
Amazing.
That comes from the Aramaic. And so you can see how genetic...
Well, that explains why the god Mammon, which is a Greek and Hebrew god, as I understand it, was shared between them because they must have common roots, the Greeks and the Hebrews somehow through...
I don't know about that. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But the alphabet comes from a common root. But the difference is you can see how mutations happen in the alphabet in that in Hebrew, it's Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Dalet, A, B, G, D. In Greek, it's Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, A, B, G, D.
That's wild.
In us, it's A, B, C, D. And that transmutation happens when it gets translated from the Hebrew and the Greek into Latin.
Fascinating. You've done your homework, Eli. And obviously, you didn't know all this when you were... homeless on the streets of Santa Monica.
No. You know, hey, it's been a long time.
So you spent years in studying contemplation after you got control of your mind and your paranoia and you threw away your M1 rifle and...
I traded it for acid, actually.
TMI? No. No. Please, though, what was it like for you after you had an easier path? Did you find yourself becoming a contemplative, an ascetic? What?
No, not at all. You know, oh. I mean, so actually, as I said, Muktananda introduced me to my partner, Tony, and this is 1975, and I've been with her ever since. So I've been living in a household as a householder. Mm-hmm. And we lived in Bolinas for 5 years. We lived in Mill Valley. We lived all around Marin County for 30 years. We lived in Maui for 7 years. And
Then you moved to Ashland.
Actually, I lived in the Applegate in 1973.
Aha. Uh-huh.
We were on a commune there. Grew my first marijuana crop in 1973. And we gave it away because we saw it was a sacred substance and we didn't want to sell it.
Beautiful.
And that was 73. And we started the seeds that were
now genetics.
The genetics in the Applegate, actually, some of that came from us.
Wow, dude. That's
rad. Williams was over the, across the side, other side.
So you helped start the Emerald Triangle.
Right. But in those days, we actually knew what we were growing because if you were smoking Thai sticks, you grew Thai. And we had Thai sticks, we had Colombian Santa Marta gold. We had, you know, Acapulco gold. And so we knew where the seeds came from. Mm. Nowadays, these kids don't know what they're doing because when the whole scene got shut down during Reagan's war on drugs, it escaped to Amsterdam. Amsterdam got the California seeds, but by then they didn't know the roots. Mm. So they started making up names. So you got White Widow. Okay, White Widow, beautiful. But what is it? Don't know. Where did it come from? Don't know. And so then you got things like, you know, strawberry bubble kush that they call sativa. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. If it says kush, it comes from the Hindu
That's
kush.
Right. That's indica.
And but you'll see in the marketplace kush called sativa.
Mm-hmm.
Because people have no clue at this point.
Uh-oh. Well, actually, I know some people, just to speak up for some of my industry friends, that are making the genetic side just now, actually, especially with the advent of the CBD market, a pivotal piece of their work and right. how to make the feminized seeds and everything. But this kind of cottage industry or communal living, did that influence your worldview in some way?
Well, it was part of my worldview. I mean, the commune was to change the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the point. And when it didn't change the world, I left the commune and tried to find something else. That has been my mission since I was 18 years old, was freedom.
Did it have a name, the commune?
Laser Farm. Susio, who started this, one of the founders of the station,
yes.
was on Laser Farm.
Here's a shout out to Susio.
Yes, Susio. Hey, sweetheart.
So there's a lot of history in you, and this book, An Outlaw Makes It Home, will probably only give us a tiny glimpse of all of your wisdom, because I can see that you're a history buff. And
I am. And actually, there was a point where I had cancer, and I was in bed for 6 months, and that gave me a time to read. And so I did more reading then than that's the kind of set my foundation for them.
And you're free of it now.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thanks. It was an incurable, fast acting, and I was in the last stage of it in 19. I was 60 years old, so whatever that was, 2006.
Praise the Most High.
And medicine.
That helps.
Yeah.
And I guess what we're trying to get to on this show, Rogue Regenesis, is, what would a regenerative world look like? What would a conscious, co-creative world in which coexistence is not such a trial look like, or how?
It starts with each one of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with each one of us being willing to be a true friend. To be a true friend is to give up selfishness. Selfishness is me and mine. If you're willing to not come from me and mine, you can be a true friend for yourself and the world. You can love yourself as you are instead of trying to love your ego. And you can love each other because you see the truth of them.
That really speaks to me, Eli, because for what it's worth, I've actually been on a hero's journey of my own, if that's not pompous to say.
It's true for everybody. Really.
In that I don't want to have anything to do with the dominant paradigm, which is why I have an alternative radio show. But
we're sitting here.
Yeah. And what we talk about is those trances
right.
that are persistent and hold people in obeisance, I guess is the word, to systems that do not serve them.
Right.
But why do we do that? Why do we allow ourselves to fritter away our golden opportunity of a human incarnation on silliness?
Because everyone is run by the egoic drives of survival, sex, and relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If you're willing to give up your personal survival, sex, and relationship, which is me and mine, you'll be free.
Well, that's a tall order, sir.
That's what keeps it all in place, is that. That is your saying, oh, not me. Yeah, but you can't preach it if you're not going to walk it.
Arguably so. Well, but that may sound puritanical to some people,
it's
see?
Not about, hey, it's not about giving up sex. It's giving up your identity. Your identity is a sexual being. Your identity is a survival being.
You mean like your cravings and appetites, those drives?
The identity.
Hmm.
What if you're not a man or a woman? For a moment. You're free of it all.
Well, and people today are trying to find their identity like they never have before. Maybe that is evidence itself of this quantum shift in the state of human consciousness, is that everybody's becoming a seeker to some extent.
Well, identity politics is actually a level of ego strengthening.
Right.
So if you've been a slave, you need ego strengthening to say, oh, hey, I'm okay. I'm black is beautiful. Yes, black is beautiful. It's great. That's a way of empowering the ego to rise up out of the ashes and make something of yourself. But then that's a stage.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you've gotten up, you've gotten your car, you've gotten your house, you got your wife and kid, whatever, and you know, you realize it's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got to take a step into the unknown.
Well, that's right, because any cause or mission or quest or crusade that you adopt will not take you all the way.
That's right.
You will have to abandon it at some stage. And
so what I'm suggesting is abandon everything right now, and then the world has a chance.
Just now, like now.
Yeah, like now.
Like Milarepa said, abandon all concepts.
That's right. In this moment. And if you're willing to, in this moment, it's like you put a stake in the ground saying, okay, it stops here.
Om Shanti.
Om Shanti.
You're fun, Eli, because you're actually affecting my consciousness right now. It's like this hyper-rational being sitting in front of this microphone is having a really hard time thinking in his usual linear fashion.
That's good. That's a confirming sign.
You're discombobulating me. Is that your job?
Silence. Silence is the answer. That will soothe your mind. It'll calm all your hyperactivity. It'll give you an opportunity to listen more quietly, deeply into yourself.
And I have heard you and Gangaji speak those very words in some of your talks, that when you're in relationship in particular, speaking is often the worst thing you can do. And silence, holding the silence, is the better posture. I know that fights that I've had have always been because I chose to speak at the wrong time.
Okay, so you're talking about strategies. I'm talking about something that finishes your life as you know it. It's different from a strategy. It's not about should I talk, should I be quiet. It's a deeper silence. It's mm-hmm. a silence that holds both speaking and non-speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's a silence that holds your possibility of being right and being wrong. It's a deeper, deeper silence that if you listen to it, you get out of your head and into the deeper recesses of your heart, where your heart is speaking to you. But it speaks so quietly, you have to be very, very subtle to hear it.
Well, they say the heart is an organ of memory because it has dendritic cells like the brain's neurons. So I do believe we have more than one center of knowledge in
Aristotle said we have three brains.
Yeah. Gut.
Gut. And then he called the animal brain, which is our emotional. And then he called the human brain, which is reason.
Mm-hmm. And all those have to be working in some relative harmony for you to experience that stillness and quiet, or?
Well, you have to start where you are and be mm-hmm. willing to commit where you are. And then you'll see where you're not. And then you face that and you deal with that.
Okay, so I know a lot of people will probably be thinking, but will this make all my PTSD go away? Will this make my pain go away? Will I be able to get along with my ex better? I mean,
all that are trying to find strategies to still continue to live the life you've been living. This is about waking up. Waking up means you don't have to continually suffer in the dream. So it's not about waking up to have a better dream. Then you're awake in the dream. Then you'll see what you'll see what your suffering is. You'll see what needs to be taken care of and what doesn't. It all becomes very obvious the quieter you are.
Peter Gabriel has a lyric that says, "Get in line with the dreamer's dream." And when you say the world does actually exist, it's a little different than what some, when you say it's a dream world, a lot of people might be thinking that it doesn't exist. In other words, that we're just creating it all out of whole cloth. But actually, you said a moment back that the world is as it is, and we're only, projecting onto it our own interpretations of what this experience means. And so I think you're right. I think silence, abiding in silence, clarifies everything, the emotional brain, the human brain, everything.
Yes. And it has nothing to do with speaking or not speaking. And it has nothing to do with activity or stillness. It's a deeper silence that is the ground of being that speaking and not speaking come from.
Oh, I see what you're saying. What do you think of the word equanimity?
That's beautiful.
So then we don't need pharmaceutical support if we have the ability to reach these centered states, or
you might need pharmaceutical support. I mean, mm-hmm. If the brain has diseases just like the body has diseases,
right.
And there's medicines for the brain's diseases like there's medicine for the body's diseases,
right?
And sometimes they're appropriate and sometimes they're not. There's no rules. When you wake up, you realize there's no rules. It's not should or shouldn't. It's not what I believe or what I think or what should. It's really the simplicity of being quiet enough to be clear about what's in front of you. Good. All right. That's good. That's very good. I like
having
this.
A little release now. So I was thinking of my next question, but it all seems so...
It all dissolved.
Relative. But are you teaching now at the Leela School?
Yeah, I just came back from Europe. I go to Europe every spring. We just had a Leela School in Amsterdam, and there'll be one here in Ashland. This Leela School is in three locations, Ashland, Amsterdam, and in Sydney, Australia.
Bloody F, mate.
Now that, it's like, how is that possible? You know, I was a poor hippie on the farm with no possessions, living in L.A., no possessions. Now here, there's a school in three continents that has, it's like, I didn't do it. I can't say, oh, look at me, I did this. I couldn't have done this. This is just what appears.
It's like a lineage. It's like your calling. And so therefore it was already prepared for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who prepared it? You know, it's like, that's still the belief that there's somebody in charge doing it for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually simpler than that.
So you're suggesting that we don't need to look to external agency, i.e. some
That's right.
God in heaven or the Tao or
angels,
because
spirit guides.
There's really no way to put your finger on it.
Higher self, spirit guides.
In fact, I ran into this amazing person in the Bay Area a couple months back. She was an Orthodox Greek nun. And I just started talking about God like in a joking fashion. And she said, well, we don't believe that we can ascribe any properties to God at all because we don't know God, you know. And that's called apophatic mysticism.
Yes.
Apophasis means you will not put one label on this reality, on your experience, on anyone or anything, because that's not going to help.
That's right.
Very good.
St. John of the Cross in Spain during the Inquisition, and actually was being tortured during the Inquisition because as an apostate priest, he wrote, I entered into unknowing, and there I remained unknowing, transcending all knowledge. And what I realize in this unknowing is beyond words. And then he goes on to write a poem that is so beautiful, transcending all knowledge.
Yes, yes. Sri Ramakrishna was preaching to his students, and he said, the cow that eats from many sources will produce copious milk. And one of the students says, but master, that milk will have a slight smell to it. And he said, ah, yes, but when boiled over the fire of knowledge, it will lose its smell.
OK. Okay.
So the idea to me is that as a seeker, I have been a student of comparative religion, and maybe I know too much. Maybe I think I'm so smart because I've studied all this stuff.
Okay, I'll give you my last little joke.
Go for it.
Okay, so the rabbi's in the temple, and he's down on his knees, and he's beating himself on his brow, on his chest, going, I am nothing, I am nothing, I am nothing. The cantor walks in, sees him, gets down on his knees, and also goes, I am nothing, I am nothing. And this is in a little shtetl in Poland, and the Polish guy who takes care of the place starts sweeping up, and he sees them up there, and he sees what they're doing. And as he's sweeping, he starts saying, I am nothing, I am nothing, I am nothing. And the rabbi looks up, looks over at the cantor, and says, so, look who thinks he's a nothing.
Eli Jackson Bear, you have been an outstanding guest, and I would love people to know how to reach you through the Leela School. Is that information right here on the book, perhaps?
It should be Leela Foundation. It's leela.org.
Spelled?
L-E-E-L-A, like Hindu Leela, meaning God's play.
God's play.
Yeah.
Yes, the Leela of God, which we are all engaged in, whether we know it or not. But
well, if you don't know it, it's called samsara.
Which is from the Zen tradition.
No, it's also Sanskrit.
Oh, it is.
It's either samsara or it's Leela. It's samsara if you don't know it and you're suffering on any degree. If you're alive, awake, happy, and free, it's Leela.
Fantastic. That helps me tremendously to see that distinction. And I'm somewhere in between.
Okay. So that's the bardo.
Yes. I may be further along than I realized, but that's a whole thing, isn't in itself, is that we're trying to gauge progress in a game we already won.
Yeah, so stop playing. That's all I'm saying. You're just not willing to cash in your chips.
Beautifully said. The book by Eli Jackson Bear is An Outlaw Makes It Home. I presume this is available from the Leela School.
It's available on Amazon, anywhere.
Leela School can be reached at leela.org, leela.org. And they are based in Ashland as well as on two other continents. I have never been to Amsterdam, and the next time you're teaching there, I'm coming.
Oh, I'll be there next spring. It's a great city. Amsterdam, the people actually still have their democracy, and they still have their true human relationships with each other. It's like, it's a livable city, and the people are livable, they're real. You know, it's like... Like the local Amsterdamer never supported marijuana, but they supported your right to have it if that was what you wanted, because they believed in freedom.
Yes, I've seen some videos on what a strong democracy it is. And hopefully you will add to the wealth of that nation with your teachings there. And I want to say thank you again for coming in and for being so entertaining. I rarely have the kind of experience that I just had, which is that... you're starting to overturn some of my own grasping tendencies in my mind, just like deconditioning me a bit. And I really appreciate it.
I'm so glad. So grateful.
I'll have a better day now, I think.
Good.
Because I was carrying stuff I didn't even know I was carrying till little Dharma dropped down on there.
Okay. Very well, then.
Peace be with you, my friend.
Namaste.
Namaste. And please say hi to Gangaji.
I will.
Friends, this has been an interview on Rogue Regenesis with Eli Jackson Bear, author of An Outlaw Makes It Home, The Awakening of a Spiritual Revolutionary, published by New Morning Books. And it is a good length, not overly long. I think you will be able to enjoy the richness of it, as Peter Coyote did, saying that he urges everyone to read it. So... got 1 minute left before the end of our broadcast, but we will go ahead and head on out with a song here by our friend Peter Gabriel called More Than This, because that's what we've just been talking about. More than this. Always, always more.
I woke up and the world outside was dark, all so quiet before the dawn. Opened opened up the door and walked outside. The ground was cold. I walked until I couldn't walk anymore. To a place I'd never been. There was something stirring.